This podcast of The Exchange is supported by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's D-O-U-C-E-T survey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Teens often get a bad rap. They're labeled impulsive, unreliable, prone to risk-taking, and poor decision-making. And recent neuroscience tells us that some of these less-than-stellar behaviors are because teens' brains aren't fully developed. But now a new book by a longtime expert on adolescence adds a new dimension to this discussion, saying while we may understand some of this newer research about the adolescent brain, we're applying that knowledge pretty poorly in our homes, our schools, and our court system. We're talking this hour on The Exchange with professor and psychologist Lawrence Steinberg about his new book, Age of Opportunity: Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Steinberg shows where public institutions and parents often go wrong when trying to guide teens through these years, and he tries to set us straight on a path that he says better reflects contemporary neuroscience. Today in The Exchange, we dive into the teen brain. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Steinberg, it's great to have you. Thanks for coming on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's easy to criticize adolescents, but you instead criticize the way society approaches them. You say, Dr. Steinberg, that adolescence is a confusing time, but it's not the people in the midst of it who are confused. You say the adults are far more bewildered by adolescence than our young people themselves. What are you trying to say there?
I think that we don't really understand our adolescents very well as adults. And I think that because of that, we've developed this notion that this is a period of development where the best you can do, either as a parent or as a kid, is just to survive it, you know, just to endure it. And actually, if you go to bookstores and you look for most of the books that are written for parents or teenagers, you'll actually see the word survive or survival in the title of many of them. And I just think this is wrong, because I think that when we go into experiences in life and the best we can hope to do is just hold our breath and get through it, we don't devote much to trying to make it a positive experience. And I think that's what's happened to the way we raise adolescents and educate them in America. We don't think that it's possibly to have a positive experience then. So I wrote Age of Opportunity to try to straighten things out.
Yeah, and it's not all happy-go-lucky, this book, of course. But talk a little bit more about that narrative. That's interesting, Dr. Steinberg. And you're right. You know, when you tell people that you have a teenager or two teenagers, they say, oh, you know, you'll get through it. Or, oh, they're almost 20. I mean, what's that narrative all about? Why do we feel so negative about this time?
I think we feel negative about it in part because it's a time when our children are changing in ways that that challenge us as parents. Kids are developing the intellectual abilities to question our decisions and to argue with us about things that they feel passionate about. And, you know, to a parent who's been put up on a pedestal for a very long time, which is, you know, really what it does feel like when you're the parent of an elementary school kid, it doesn't feel so hot to be knocked off that pedestal. And I think that this is often misinterpreted by parents as indicative of rebelliousness. And it's not. I try to help parents understand, look, don't take this personally. It's not about you. It's about growing up. And I think once parents understand what adolescence is truly about as a life stage, they can have a much better time with it. And just one last point on this is that studies show that parents who go into adolescence expecting the worst bring it out in their kids. And that's true for teachers as well. So the attitude with which we approach adolescence really does make a difference in how it turns out.
Well, so hence the title of the book, Age of Opportunity. Again, that's a very different title for a book about adolescence. The book is not all doom and gloom. Let's talk about that opportunity, Dr. Steinberg, relating to how malleable the brain is, how plastic it is at this time.
Right. So we've known for some time that the brain is plastic at all stages. You know, the brain changes in response to experience. That's what we mean by plasticity. But the kind of plastic brain we have in adulthood is very different than the kind we have in childhood or adolescence, because the kinds of changes that take place in the brain during adulthood are very minor modifications, whereas those that take place before adulthood involve developing whole new brain circuits and eliminating brain circuits that aren't efficient anymore, aren't needed anymore. And adolescence really is the last time in life when the brain undergoes that degree of transformation. Now, we've known for a long time that the brain is very malleable during the early years of life. Sometimes we refer to this as 0 to 3. But it's a very recent revelation that the brain is also malleable again during adolescence. And when we think about what that means, I think you have to conclude that plasticity cuts both ways. The malleable brain is malleable in response to positive experiences that help build a better brain, but it's also malleable in response to toxic experiences that have harmful effects. I think we focus a lot in our discussions of adolescence about the downside of adolescence, but we don't focus on the fact that the same plasticity of the brain that makes adolescence a vulnerable period makes it a time of opportunity. And I wanted to shift the discussion in this book to talk more about what we can do to promote positive development.
Well, and as a mom of two, I appreciate you shifting it to a more positive tone, because you're right, there is that sort of negative narrative out there. Let me invite our listeners to join us, Dr. Steinberg, and then a lot more questions for you. You can join our conversation, too. We're talking with Lawrence Steinberg. He's a renowned national expert on adolescence. His new book is called Age of Opportunity: Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. What do you want to know about why teens behave the way they do and how their brains may be involved in that behavior? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And here's a Facebook comment that came in before the show, Dr. Steinberg, from Sherry. She says, "My comment isn't about teen behavior. It's about adult behavior. If we know that teens' brains aren't fully developed until they're at least in their mid-20s, why do we insist on treating them at home, in schools, in healthcare, in workplaces, as though they are adults? We expect 18 to 19-year-olds to make life-altering decisions on their own. Our criminal justice system treats young people like adults. Our schools are not generally set up in age-appropriate ways. If they were, Sherry says, high school would not start at 7:30. That's a whole topic right there. Sherry says, we know what we need to do to foster healthy development in young people. Why do we consistently fail to do it? Sherry, thank you for the Facebook comment. What do you think, Dr. Steinberg?
I've been asking Sherry's question for about 40 years.
Yeah, that's what the book is about.
How long I've been in this field. I agree entirely. So in some senses, the book was motivated by my coming to the realization that there is such a disconnect between what science tells us about adolescence and what the popular portrayal of the period is and what the policies are that guide how we treat adolescents. Let's just consider this for a moment. In Pennsylvania, where I live, you can try a child for murder as an adult at the age of 12 years old, on the grounds that somebody that age should know better. But you can't buy beer until you're 21 in this same state. We're obviously very confused about what adolescence is and what people are capable of doing at this age. It doesn't make any sense to say that you're mature enough for your own behavior to be held to adult standards of criminal responsibility when you're 12, but that you're not mature enough to make a decision about whether you want to drink or not until you're 21. All kinds of things reveal this sort of inconsistency and confusion. We let people drive when they're 16. Driving is among the most dangerous things we do, and yet we won't let them watch R-rated movies until they're 17. That strikes me as reflecting a kind of cluelessness, I think, on our part. And in the book, the book is aimed at parents and it's aimed at educators, but it's also aimed at, I think, the kind of people that Sherry wants to be paying attention to, and that's policymakers and legislators, to say, let's step back and look at the laws that guide how we treat young people and ask if they really, truly make sense, given what we know about adolescent development.
Policies from when you can drink to when you can drive, join the military, vote, who knows what else. Although you hit on something that I did want to ask you about, Dr. Steinberg. New Hampshire just recently changed its juvenile justice policies. The age at which you can be tried like an adult is back up to 18 from 17. And when we talked about this, you know, we did talk to some people who said, look, you know, there are some really terrible crimes that 17-year-olds do, and at some level, they should know better. You know, you can't just let kids off the hook like, oh, gee, you know, you conducted an armed robbery, but you're only 16, so go ahead, you're free. I mean, how do you find that balance? You can't just say, your brain isn't developed, you didn't know any better, go back home.
Well, look, the alternative to trying a child as an adult is not saying, okay, you go free, we're not going to do anything about it. And this is a big misconception out there. We can hold kids responsible for their behavior within the juvenile justice system. We can punish them within the juvenile justice system. We can lock them up within the juvenile justice system. But we do those things in ways that are more age appropriate, and they're going to maximize the chances of this young person coming back out rehabilitated and able to be a participating member of the community. There have been now many studies that have compared juveniles who have been tried and sanctioned as adults with a matched sample of kids the same age, committed the same crime, have the same background, same number of priors, but who were tried and sanctioned as juveniles. And guess what? The ones who were tried and sanctioned as adults are more likely to reoffend, they're more likely to reoffend sooner, and they're more likely to reoffend more seriously. So from the perspective of public safety, it's bad policy to try kids as adults.
But it feels good to make them, quote-unquote, learn their lesson.
Well, you know, it might feel good for a parent to spank their child, but that doesn't mean that it's good for the child. And we don't know if kids learn lessons better if they're tried as adults than if they're tried as kids. Part of learning the lesson is undergoing some kind of therapeutic intervention that teaches you the lesson. I'm not so sure that just throwing somebody into a cell teaches very much of a lesson that's going to have lifelong implications.
Well, in coming up in just a moment, Dr. Steinberg, we'll talk a little bit more about what you say about how long adolescence lasts, and brace yourselves, exchange listeners. Dr. Steinberg says adolescence today goes roughly from age 10 to 25. So we'll look at that, why it lasts so long, what the implications are. They're not all bad, he says. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. We'll continue taking your comments. Sherry, thank you for that Facebook comment. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What do you want to know about why teens behave the way they do and how their brains might be involved in that behavior? 1-800-892-6477. More with Dr. Lauren Steinberg and his book, Age of Opportunity, in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Dr. Lauren Steinberg. He's the author of the new book, Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Given what we now know about the adolescent brain, that it isn't fully developed until the early 20s, how might that change public policy, the ages at which we allow teens to drive, to drink, to vote, to live on their own, etc.? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Steinberg, so let's jump into what we mean by adolescence. Most people think it means 13 to 19, right? Teenage. You say, 10 to 25. Wow. How did that happen?
I think that'll come as a surprise to many listeners.
Well,
those of us who study adolescence typically define it as beginning in biology but ending in culture. So we have a very good biological marker of when adolescence begins, and that's puberty. And the age at which kids go through puberty has been dropping. It continues to drop. At the beginning of the 20th century, the average American girl got her first period, began menstruating when she was 14 and a half. Today it's closer to 12. So that's a pretty big drop amount of time. There have been comparable declines in the age of puberty for boys as well. A little bit harder to track so specifically because we don't have an event for boys that's like getting your first period, which is easy to measure and recorded in pediatricians' offices. On the other end, it's being stretched. I mean, people are spending more time in school. They're delaying getting married. They're delaying becoming parents. They're staying economically, financially dependent on their parents for a longer period of time. So just a couple of concrete illustrations. Today's 25-year-olds are twice as likely to still be students as their parents were when they were 25, and only half as likely to be married, and 50% more likely to be taking money from their parents. So clearly it's taking people longer to move into the conventional roles of adulthood. And when you do the math and you see how adolescence is being stretched at both ends, what you conclude, as I did, is that it's a 15-year period now. And that's twice as long as it was in 1950 and three times as long as it was in the 19th century. The reason this is important goes back to something we were speaking about earlier in the show. If you approach adolescence as something to survive, to just get through, maybe you could have done that when it was a short period of time. But I think that given the fact that it's 15 years, it's just too long to take that approach to it. So we need a new way of thinking about adolescence, a new model for what adolescence is.
Well, let's talk about the earlier end. And I definitely want to talk to you about the later end, too. And we've done plenty of shows, Dr. Steinberg, on, you know, what people call adult adolescence. As you said, the 20-somethings, you know, living at home, getting more financial help from mom and dad than perhaps mom and dad did. But what about on the early years? You know, you mentioned girls having their periods earlier. In the book, you talk about boys. The comparable experience maybe is their voices lowering earlier. What's behind this reduction in age for the onset of adolescence?
There are three or four principal contributors. The most important one is obesity. And we know that children who are fatter go through puberty earlier than children who are thinner. That's very well established. And because there's been an epidemic of childhood obesity for so long now in the United States, that has driven down the average age at which kids go into puberty. So that's one. Number two is the increased exposure of our children to endocrine disrupting chemicals. These chemicals interfere with normal function of our hormone systems, and they are ubiquitous in modern life today. They're in food, they're in cosmetics, they're in plastics, and not just water bottles. They're in plastics that we sit on, and they're in pesticides as well. And these chemicals have been shown to make puberty occur earlier as well. And then finally, and this I think will be a surprise to a lot of listeners, I know it was a surprise to me when I first got into the scientific literature on this, is that the increased exposure of our kids to artificial light may be playing a role as well. There's some new research suggesting that the kind of light that's emitted from computer monitors, smartphones, tablets, the devices that all of our kids spend so much time with now, that this light may actually also hasten the onset of puberty as well. So those are the main factors that are driving this down. And I'll tell you that when you look at surveys of pediatricians, you will see that they are reporting more and more girls who are as young as 7 or 8 years old showing signs of breast development. And that's about second grade. So this is really very different than what we've been accustomed to in the past.
Wow. So don't park your 5-year-old in front of the iPad all day long.
For all kinds of reasons. You know, we also know that that when we use these devices, and this is true for adults too, that when we use them at night, they make it harder to fall asleep. So if you do like to read before you go to sleep at night, it's much better to read a regular old paper book with a regular old lamp than it is to be staring at these lit up screens.
All right. Well, let's go to our listeners, Dr. Steinberg, and then a lot more questions for you about this. Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. The guest, Dr. Lawrence Steinberg, the book Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And let's go first to David in Dublin. Hi, David. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested to know what the effect is of screen time on brain development, and in particular, do we know what activities are bad? For instance, you know, these days when you hand a computer to your son or daughter, you're not only giving them their homework sort of mechanism, but you're also handing them an entertainment center. So there's this constant struggle about, I should monitor it, I shouldn't monitor it, and what is bad? My son, you know, he's having his relaxation time, he's 14, he tends to have half the screen watching a little bit of TV and the other half doing something else. And I'm trying to get him to read, and I've made this contingent upon reading half an hour. So how does one evaluate what is bad for them and what is okay?
Yeah, and the impact on the brain, that plastic developing brain, it's a good question. What do you think, Dr. Steinberg?
I don't think we know the answer to it. It's a terrific question. I mean, I think we do know that using these devices a lot has effects on kids' abilities to pay attention to things. I think we need to worry a little bit about too much multitasking, which then I think improves our ability to engage in what psychologists call divided attention, that is doing more than one thing at once, but I think it impairs our ability to engage in what we call focused attention. So it's a mixed bag in that respect. To me, when I think about this, I like to ask parents to consider not so much what's happening to their kids because of these devices, but what their kids aren't doing with the time that they're spending on these things. And we need to make sure that our children get enough exercise, that they get enough sleep, that they have some time when they're actually unplugged, that they engage in social relationships involving face-to-face contact and not just internet-based contact. So I don't think that, it's not simple. So I don't think that that we ought to be coming down either wholly positive or wholly negative about kids' involvement with these devices. It's like saying, is watching television bad for you? Well, are you watching Masterpiece Theater or are you watching Jersey Shore? Because the answer is going to be different. But I think we can agree that even if you were just watching Masterpiece Theater, we wouldn't want you doing nothing but doing that. So I'm more concerned with the sheer amount of time kids are spending on these devices.
Our phone number again for you to join us, like David did, 1-800-892-6477. What do you want to know about why teens behave the way they do? What strategies do you think work and don't work when it comes to working effectively with this age group? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So given what you're saying, Dr. Steinberg, and what neuroscience tells us, what does this mean for public policies towards teens, whether it's when they can drink or live on their own or sign up for the military or drive? I mean, if you could change like two policies, what would it be? Would it be not allow them to drive till they're 18? Allow them to drink at 16, don't allow them to live on their own till they're 20. If you could just change like one or two, what would that be?
Well, in the book, I talk about the distinction that psychologists draw between cold cognition and hot cognition. So cold cognition is the way that we think about things under ideal circumstances, when we're not emotionally aroused, when we have time to make a reasoned decision. Hot cognition is the way that we think when we're extremely excited or upset or overjoyed, or in a group situation where our emotions are running wild. What we know from studies of adolescent development is that by the time kids are 16, they perform just as well as adults on tests of cold cognition.
So they're smart.
But just as well. But they don't perform as well on tests of hot cognition as adults until they're in their early 20s. So that suggests that we might think about policies in terms of what do they require? Is this a hot cognitive decision or is this a cold cognitive decision? So I have an essay coming out in the Los Angeles Times tomorrow on Election Day to talk about the fact that we should think about lowering the voting age, because there's no evidence at all that a 16-year-old can't make that decision as intelligently as an adult. Now, as I point out, that doesn't mean they'll always make correct decisions, but that's true for adults when they go in the voting booth as well. They just won't make them any worse on average than adults do. On the other hand, if you look at things that require hot cognition, like driving or deciding how to extricate yourself from a crime situation, there we probably should have a higher age where we draw a boundary between adolescents and adults. We would save a lot of lives in this country if we would raise the driving age to 18. We have one of the lowest driving ages in the world, frankly. I know that's not a popular thing to say for people living in a rural state like New Hampshire, but You know, our driving age was determined at a time in our history when we were a very, very different kind of country than we are now, when a lot of people who were 16 needed to get to work. That's not the case anymore.
That's really interesting. So cold cognition is something you think about, and voting, certainly you've got plenty of time to think about it. Hot cognition more is that instantaneous, you're under pressure, you're under stress. That's where teens or adolescents don't make as good a decision as the adult. So,
right,
so exactly. Driving, what else would be an area of hot cognition where we might want to think about changing the age?
Well, I think that some of these instances, the age is right, because we have seen these things as hot cognition. I don't think that we should have a drinking age that's very low, because that, again, when people are deciding to drink, they often are not involved in cold cognition. Their emotions are running wild. The way in which we treat kids under the law, because we know that when kids are involved, when we look at the circumstances under which kids commit crimes compared to adults, kids are much more likely to be emotionally aroused and with other kids. Those are two of the things that we know undermine adolescent thinking and judgment. So that's part of the basis that we used in making the argument that kids should be treated differently from adults when they break the law, even if they break very serious laws. And, you know, we brought that evidence to bear on several Supreme Court cases, and we were victorious there in getting the Supreme Court to abolish the juvenile death penalty and to place limits on the use of life without parole for kids who've committed their crimes when they're younger than 18, because of recognizing that under these hot cognitive circumstances when crimes occur, kids don't have the judgment or decision-making abilities of adults.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you in just a minute, Dr. Steinberg, about sort of the messaging that adults give kids on don't do this, don't do that, you could be in a car crash, you could become a drug addict. Definitely want to ask you about that, because you say in the book that some of this messaging doesn't work as well as we might hope. But let's take another call. Gretchen's in Dover. Hi, Gretchen. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, Dr. Steinberg. What I'm interested in, actually in everything you've been saying. I teach lifespan development, and adolescence is my favorite aspect of it. But what I was particularly interested in today is if you could speak a little bit to the effects of maybe trauma or trauma during adolescence on the brain development.
Certainly. Sure. And you talk about that in the book, that, you know, you talked about plasticity works both ways, Dr. Steinberg. You know, great opportunities are super. They're implanted upon the brain, but so is trauma. Thanks for the call, Gretchen.
Right. So, you know, we talked about plasticity and malleability earlier without really distinguishing among different parts of the brain, because the brain isn't plastic in all places at the same ages. So there are parts of the brain that are especially plastic during infancy, but they're no longer plastic during adulthood. Vision is one of those. Fine motor development is one of those. On the other hand, there are parts of the brain that remain very plastic during adolescence. And one region of the brain that is so is the prefrontal cortex. That's the part of the brain directly behind your forehead, and that's the part of the brain that we think of as the brain's chief executive officer. What we know about trauma is that exposure to trauma and stress during periods when the prefrontal cortex is plastic disrupt the development of prefrontal systems. And that's important because one of the most critical functions that the prefrontal cortex serves is in something that psychologists call self-regulation, which in some ways is just a fancy way of saying self-control. And so one of the effects of exposure to trauma during adolescence is that it undermines the development of brain systems that support self-control. And so kids who are exposed to a lot of trauma in life, but particularly during the early years and during the adolescent years, have much more difficulty controlling their behavior. And this is why there's an association between exposure to trauma and acting out and behavior problems and substance abuse problems and so forth.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty profound. Thank you for the call, Gretchen. So this whole thing boils down to self-control. And if you have a lot of trauma early in your life or in your teenage years, you're going to have a problem controlling yourself later. So you decide to rob the convenience store, even though you know better.
Poor self-control is probably the greatest lifelong liability a person can have. I mean, there have been hundreds of studies done showing that kids who are low in self-control, do much worse in school, they have worse relationships, they're more prone to emotional problems, they're much more likely to get into trouble. So if you're a parent out there and there's one characteristic you can instill in your child growing up, it's having a strong sense of self-control. And I spend part of the time in the book talking about what parents can do to help facilitate this and what schools ought to be doing to help facilitate this as well.
Well, give us just a little taste of how we might instill more self-control, because you're right, it seems fundamental to everything, really, in terms of success.
Well, there's a style of parenting that we call authoritative parenting. And it's parenting that during adolescence combines three things. The first is warmth and involvement. So authoritative parents are loving and affectionate and involved in their kids' lives. A second is being firm. So authoritative parents have rules and expectations and they enforce them. And a third is being supportive of your child's gradually increasing needs for more autonomy and independence. I describe a process called scaffolding, where you give your child increasingly more challenging or demanding things to be responsible for, but you don't do it in such a way that's going to overwhelm the child. Now, parents who do these three things, authoritative parents, have children who are much more likely to score high on measures of self-control and self-regulation, and as a consequence, they're much more likely to do better in school and have greater social competence and be less prone to develop emotional or behavioral problems. So I think the most important things that parents can do is to practice this style of parenting called authoritative parenting.
Well, and coming up in just a moment, Dr. Steinberg, we'll talk a little bit more about what you say about the role of socioeconomic status in this whole equation. And we will also get to the good news, which is the opportunity that the malleability of the brain presents at this period of time. Also talking about those, again, the 20-somethings and how this is a great opportunity for them with their brains still very plastic. So lots more to talk about in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Lawrence Steinberg. His new book is called Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Dr. Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University and a renowned adolescent development expert. Again, the book is called Age of Opportunity. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. If there's anything you want to ask Dr. Steinberg about why teens behave the way they do, how their brain development might be involved in that behavior. Also, what strategies work and don't work when it comes to this age group. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Steinberg, before we go too much further, let's talk a little bit more about the plus side of this. Again, age of opportunity. You say, you know, there's a lot of angst among baby boomer parents whose 20-somethings can't seem to get it together, to use their words. But you say, don't lose heart. There's actually some good in this.
There is. So we've been talking about the beginning of adolescence and what puberty does. And one of the things that puberty does to the brain is it makes it more plastic. We've now better understand the connections between the impact of sex hormones on the brain and the brain's increase in malleability at that time period. But we haven't yet discussed what closes the window of plasticity, because we know that as we move from adolescence into adulthood, it becomes harder and harder for the brain to change. The window doesn't close all the way. It's never completely shut, but it gets very close to being completely shut then. And so then the question is there something that we can do to keep this window open a little bit longer? Because once it's shut, it's impossible to reopen it again, at least with our current understanding of things and technology. Well, it turns out that exposure to novelty and challenge during this plastic period of the brain not only is good for you at that moment, but it also helps to prime the brain to stay plastic a little bit longer. Now, we don't think you can keep your brain that plastic forever. There are all kinds of good evolutionary reasons why we wouldn't want that to happen. But there is reason to believe that by being exposed to demanding interesting, stimulating, challenging experiences during the adolescent and early adult years, we can keep that brain plasticity going for a little bit longer. Now, with that in mind, it's important to ask, well, what happens when people move from adolescence into the conventional roles of adulthood? And I think that for most individuals, they move from environments where things are less predictable, they're more novel, they're more challenging, into ones where they're very routine and very repetitive and where there isn't a lot of novelty. Think about what happens when you start an entry-level job. You pretty much are doing the same thing over and over again. Even think about what happens after you become married. Then after a while, you and your partner typically fall into a routine where you're doing the same things over and over again. My point simply is that as we become adults, we typically trade a life that's more novel and unpredictable and challenging and stimulating for one that is more routine and more repetitive. That is going to help close that window of plasticity.
A little bit earlier.
And the earlier you move into those roles, the earlier that window is going to be shut. So when I hear all this discussion and see all this hand-wringing about the fact that kids are taking longer to become adults, I say, whoa, let's hold on a second here and let's ask whether this is really such a bad thing, because maybe it's good for the brain to take it a little bit more slowly.
Well, and I thought that was really interesting because there is a lot of hand-wringing about it. But you do say, Dr. Steinberg, that there's a socioeconomic factor there, that people who can afford to go to college, maybe even go to graduate school, maybe travel in their early 20s, they're getting the benefits of that plasticity, of that malleable time for the brain, whereas people who have to hunker down earlier in life aren't getting those benefits. It's kind of unfair.
It's another kind of inequality, and it begins very early in life. We were talking a little while ago about the importance of the prefrontal cortex for self-regulation. And as we have moved into a world in which it's important to get many, many years of education in order to be successful in the labor force, that's going to favor people that have a lot of self-regulation, because you have to be able to stay in school for a very long time. Well, kids who are born into poverty come into the world with less well-developed prefrontal cortical regions because of bad prenatal nutrition. They're exposed to the kind of parenting that disrupts prefrontal development, harsh, punitive parenting. They don't go to schools that have a lot to offer in terms of stimulation of those parts of the brain. And they're often rushed into adult roles prematurely because their families can't afford to keep them in higher education for a longer period of time. So this neurobiological disadvantage kind of accumulates over time, and I do believe that it is contributing to this income gap between the haves and the have-nots.
Wow. All right. Well, let's take another call. This is Peter in Durham. Hey, Peter, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm thinking about the correlation that might exist between creativity and the lack of self-control in adolescence. I've made it through adolescence, and I was not the most self-controlling person, but through that, I found art that I could do. I'm a potter now, and I don't think that I ever would have gotten into that if I had a more authoritative parenting, because I think I probably would have gone into higher education, but that's just...
Okay, Peter, thank you. And your phone's kind of cracking out there, so I'll let you go. But the correlation between creativity and self-control or lack thereof. Peter, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Dr. Steinberg?
I think that, there are always exceptions to the rule, but it's largely a myth. I mean, if you look at the daily routines of people that have been our most successful and creative artists, musicians, scientists, and so forth, that they had extremely high self-control, that these were individuals who were very disciplined and who worked a very rigorous schedule every day. So I think this notion, that self-control interferes with creative processes, it just simply isn't true. We don't see any evidence for that at all.
That's interesting, because you do, rock stars, for example, some of them are famous drug addicts, and yet they still seem to just, produce this amazing music. I mean, there's that image out there, true or not?
Yeah, I mean, there's an image, but when people have actually tabulated the data, and looked at what the daily routines have been of our most creative artists or musicians, I think you would say you would see that the vast majority of them were very, very disciplined and not kind of wild and crazy at all.
You know, we did a program earlier on marijuana, looking at marijuana and its impact on the brain. And I did want to ask you a question about this, Dr. Steinberg. We keep reading that, you know, if you smoke your first joint at 14, it's a lot more problematic than if you smoke it at 18, and it's even better, if you can put it that way, if you smoke it at 18. What is happening in terms of those pleasure receptors in that adolescent brain and the impact of substance abuse on that teenage brain?
Well, one of the parts of the brain that is being remodeled during the early part of adolescence is the brain's reward centers, and these are parts of the brain that respond to positive and rewarding stimuli, whether it's drugs or food or sex or money or praise. It all ultimately comes down to the same brain region that gives us that sense of pleasure.
Or the coins that you collect in the video game, you know, when you succeed.
Exactly.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And because these brain regions are still plastic during adolescence, the way in which they develop is affected by the experiences that are happening in those brain regions during that time period. And what we do know is that individuals, as you said, Laura, individuals who are exposed to recreational drugs before the age of 15 are 7 to 10 times more likely to develop an addiction than people who have the same exposure but wait until they're 21. And we know that it's not simply because the kinds of people that would choose to be exposed at that early age are different, because this research has also been done with animals where they're randomly assigned to either have their exposure to nicotine or alcohol or cocaine when they're juvenile animals, and then others who are randomly assigned to have their first exposure when they're adults. And the ones whose exposure was at an earlier age are much more likely to develop an addiction. So it is because of brain plasticity, and this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, which is, as you said, plasticity cuts both ways.
Right.
The same plasticity that makes adolescence a time of opportunity makes it a time of vulnerability. And one aspect of that vulnerability is vulnerability to the long-lasting, enduring effects of drug use.
So the messaging we give kids, Dr. Steinberg, you know, don't do drugs, don't drink and drive. I mean, you write in the book that intellectually adolescents know this, and yet they still make those bad choices.
Yeah. I think that our approach to health education in this country is premised on this idea that if we just tell kids not to do these things, that they won't do them. And we know that doesn't work. So school-based health education programs have been shown to be effective at changing what kids know, but not very effective at changing how they behave.
Wow, that's really depressing.
We've changed what they know, but not what they do. And I think that the reason is that if we look a little bit more deeply at why kids engage in risky and reckless behavior during adolescence, what we see is, and it's too long of a story for us to discuss this morning, perhaps another time, the adolescence as a period of development evolved to be a time when people are willing to take risks. And to try to get kids not to do these things just by telling them don't, it's an uphill battle against evolution and endocrinology, and it's not a battle that we're going to win.
So what do you do?
I think there are things that we can do, and we should focus on changing the context that kids live in rather than trying to change kids into something that they're not. So one example might involve expanding after-school programming for people this age. We know that the prime time now for experimentation with sex and drugs and delinquent behavior is in the afternoon hours, between 3 and 6 in the afternoon, when parents are at work and kids are out of school. Now, we can continue to delude ourselves that having kids in the classroom and saying don't have sex without using protection or don't try drugs is going to deter those behaviors, or we can just say, why don't we give kids activities and settings during those hours that are fun and stimulating and beneficial to them and supervised by adults So we minimize the amount of time that kids are spending in unstructured, unsupervised activities, because that's the recipe for experimentation with those problematic behaviors.
And yet, on the other hand, and we've done a dozen shows on this, too, there's another school of thought these days, I'm sure you're familiar with this, Dr. Steinberg, that kids of all ages are overscheduled and overstructured, and their brains aren't, you know, they don't have time to sort of think of their own ideas because they're always being watched by adults. So it's a tough balance, isn't it?
Well, I think that it is a tough balance. I think that you can arrange for programming for kids that isn't of the stressful kind of competitive nature that characterizes a lot of the overscheduling that kids experience today. Kids do need time by themselves.
Downtime, yeah.
But they need downtime. But it's not clear that having that 3 hours every day when you're home with your friends and there are no parents around is the way we want that downtime to be.
All right, let's take one more call if we could. And Jean's in Concord. Hi, Jean. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange with Dr. Steinberg.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about the implication of your theory on the age for men and women to join the armed forces or legally own a gun.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Jean, for calling in. And boy, Israel does it differently, don't they, Dr. Steinberg? I think you join the military you have to join between ages 19 and 21. So
yeah,
that's one way to handle teenagers.
Well, it's quite complicated. A lot of the people in the military in the United States are adolescents. A huge proportion of people serving the country in that way are under 21 years old, much less under 25. You know, I think that societies have always, in some senses, exploited the risk-taking willingness of people this age in forming military groups. This is why we recruit people who are 18, 19 years old to go to combat, because they're willing to take risks that people who are older aren't willing to do. Whether you think that's a good idea or not, I think that in part is a political decision that you have to make. But certainly, we should be aware of what we're doing. I think that the numbers will tell us that we wouldn't be able to sustain the size of the defense that we need or that we believe we need if we excluded people who are under 21 from the services.
Well, it's interesting, and it's a good question, actually. I wonder how much military commanders are up on this brain science that you talk
about.
Well,
they are. I mean, we actually have a grant from the Army to see if we can understand better how people who are on the younger side of things, 18, 19-year-olds, might fare differently if they were grouped more often with people who were slightly older than just grouped among people their own age.
Interesting. Well, I have to ask you this too, Dr. Steinberg. Another caller who couldn't stay on wanted to know about the differences between the male and female brains. And certainly, I hate to say it, but most of the examples in your book are about young males behaving badly. There's a few examples of girls, but it's mostly the guys.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the question of whether male and female brains are different has a kind of yes and no answer to it. The yes part is that the tendencies to seek out exciting and novel and potentially dangerous experiences are all much stronger among males than among females. The ability to restrain those impulses and to exercise better self-regulation is stronger among females than among males. So to the extent that combination of poor impulse control and high sensation seeking is what gets kids into trouble, yes, males are much more likely to have that bad combination. That's where they're different. On the other hand, the way in which the brain changes during adolescence is actually quite similar for males and females. So both sexes enjoy improvements in self-control over the course of adolescence and into early adulthood. Both sexes show this increase in reward-seeking, sensation-seeking behavior during the early part of an adolescence and then a decline afterwards. So there are some differences between males and females, but there are a lot of similarities as well. And frankly, my own view is that I don't think that the differences between the male brain and the female brain are striking enough during adolescence to say we can't educate boys and girls together. There isn't any evidence, really, that boys and girls learn differently.
Okay. Well, Dr. Steinberg, I have 10,000 more questions I could ask you. We have to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That's Dr. Lauren Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University, author of the new book, Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Mikesell. Our intern is Joanna Albertson-Grove. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, should the Girl Scouts hike a new path? For more than 100 years, this organization has shaped generations of girls, and every generation has had its own ideas about what scouting should be all about. Now, some girls and their leaders say efforts to modernize programming have moved too far away from traditional focuses like the great outdoors. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners, and support also comes to us from Ford and McPartland, PA, representing businesses, trustees, and institutional creditors in bankruptcy and troubled debt matters. Ford and McPartland, PA. And Simmons College of Nursing and Health Sciences graduate programs for careers in health education, nursing, nutrition, and physical therapy. Registration for information sessions at simmons.edu.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. An estimated 10 million more Americans have health insurance as a result of the Affordable Care Act. But whether the law can be called a success so far remains unclear, with ongoing concerns over affordability and access to care. Recent polls show a majority of Americans still have an unfavorable view of the ACA. As we approach the enrollment period beginning November 15th, many point to confusion over what will happen to premiums for those already signed up and how to go about getting or changing a plan. A look at how well the Affordable Care Act has performed to date and what to expect for its future. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. As the clock ticks down to tomorrow's midterm elections, both Republicans and Democrats are working to turn out supporters. NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Obama headlined 3 get-out-the-vote rallies over the weekend.
President Obama told supporters in Michigan, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania not to give up any of their political power this year by sitting out the midterm elections. Democrats are typically less reliable voters in non-presidential years than Republicans are, but Obama's party's trying to counter that with a sophisticated ground game.
If you want something better, you've got to vote for it.
Obama's own sagging approval numbers have been a liability for many Democrats this year, especially Senate incumbents running in deeply red states. The president's rallies over the weekend were for 3 gubernatorial candidates, as well as 1 Democratic Senate candidate in Michigan who has a large lead in the polls. Scott Horsley, NPR News. Washington.
Federal officials say a mechanical device deployed too early on the spaceship that broke up last week. The Virgin Galactic spaceship crashed in the California desert on Friday. The National Transportation Safety Board says it will take months to learn the cause of the accident. Virgin Galactic's founder, Richard Branson, told NBC, despite the tragedy, company engineers will continue to work toward achieving private space travel.
They're not going to down tools. They're going to move forward and